Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the NewsHour tonight, Congress passes a temporary measure to keep the government funded and avoid a shutdown. The Department of Justice issues a scathing review of the police response to the 2022 Uvalde, Texas school massacre, calling it a failure. And a doctor who worked in Gaza details the increasingly dire humanitarian situation faced by civilians caught in the Israel-Hamas war.
We cannot look away anymore, and there needs to be a sustained ceasefire in order for us to be able to provide basic human services and dignity to the people of Gaza.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Congress has avoided a partial federal government shutdown with just one day to spare. The temporary funding bill passed with strong bipartisan support. But a long-term fix and tougher debates remain, including over Ukraine funding and border security. Lisa Desjardins is here to explain what it all means. So, Lisa, sign of the times, Congress makes headlines just for doing its job and keeping the government funded. How'd they do it?
Temporarily doing their jobs, I remind
Temporarily,
you.
Right.
Well, this passed overwhelmingly, first in the Senate and then overwhelmingly in the House in a matter of hours. Why? Because a snowstorm is coming, approaching Washington, D.C., and to be honest, lawmakers want to get out of town. But it is a sign of success for the new Speaker, Mike Johnson, threading a needle here, passing bipartisan bills that were important despite opposition from conservatives in his party. So government will not shut down, at least not this month. This moves deadlines back to March, when we are very likely to be speaking about this again. But meanwhile, as you said, there are still pressing concerns right now urgently over Ukraine funding and also over border security. Now, I can report that the border security team says they're closing in on a deal, but those two issues are now linked. They're trying to put text together, not only for border security details, but the amount of money for Ukraine. Senator Chris Murphy, who's one of the negotiators, spoke about this complicated maneuver.
So we have to land two planes at once. One is the conversation we're having about changes in border policy. The other is the dollar amounts for the supplemental. And, you know, it's possible that that could be ready for next week, but there's still work to do.
Still work to do. We're going to be watching this closely. We'll see if we get text this weekend or not.
Meantime, House Republicans are working quickly to advance impeachment proceedings against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Where does that all stand?
There was an emotional hearing today that House Republicans held in the House Homeland Security Committee. Significant because it is probably the last hearing on this issue before they move to articles of impeachment. They asked Secretary Mayorkas to appear. He said he had scheduling conflicts because a delegation from Mexico is coming. They say he tried to reschedule, but that the House Republicans didn't respond. Now, in that hearing, the House members laid out, Republicans laid out their case that they think Secretary Mayorkas should, in fact, be impeached. Here's the chairman of the committee, Mark Green.
This is not a policy difference. The truth is, Secretary Mayorkas has disregarded court orders, laws passed by the United States Congress, and has lied to the American people.
Now, of course, Mayorkas and Democrats decry that. They say that that is misinformation, in their words. The lie that that Republicans are talking about, they say when Secretary Mayorkas said the border is under operational control, they say that's a lie. The secretary says you have to have a reasonable standard. He also says he needs more resources. They're doing more than they have ever done before in terms of larger numbers of deporting people that we've ever seen, more fentanyl seizures than we've ever seen. But Republicans brought a series of witnesses today that were emotional. One mother, for example, whose daughter was killed by an undocumented immigrant, MS-13 member. Another mother whose daughter died from a fentanyl overdose. Now, Democrats responded with sympathy, of course. These were very strong, tragic and powerful stories. But they said, we're not sure that really has to do with the impeachment of Secretary Mayorkas. Here's one of the members of Congress.
You brought them here, unfortunately, where our solutions may not be the solutions that they seek. Under the false pretense that impeaching Secretary Mayorkas would be in any way prevent what happened to their children from happening to someone else's.
The timing of this, though, Republicans, House Republicans are on track, I'm told by sources, to move on articles of impeachment, likely the last week of this month.
Really? Do House Republicans, though, with their slimmest of slim majorities, do they have the votes to impeach him?
a numbers question, an amazing time that we live in. Let's look at what's going on in the House right now. Okay, so we have 220 Republicans because we've got two vacancies at the moment, over 213 Democrats. However, there are two Republicans who are absent for illness or one was in a car accident. Now, that is close, but next week, another Republican will retire, leave his position. So next week, Jeff, 217 to 13, that's a one-vote margin. Why is it a one-vote margin? Because if you move two votes from Republicans to Democrats, it's a tie, 215 to 215. Ties fail. Essentially, the new speaker can only lose one vote on any issue and have it pass with only Republicans. Now, it does seem that they are generally unified on this Mayorkas impeachment idea, and there may even be some Democratic support. So just by the narrowest of margins, it looks like they do have the support.
In-House Republicans apparently have their hands full with these investigations and impeachments because they're also now trying to further their investigation of Hunter Biden. But there was a vote to hold him in contempt. Where does that stand?
A quick update on this. Hunter Biden has agreed just tonight to, in fact, give testimony behind closed doors. That was the contempt issue. We expect that testimony February 28th. So for the moment, contempt is off the table. Hunter Biden will be speaking to investigators on the House side next month.
Lisa Desjardins, on top of all of it, as always, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
In the day's other headlines, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed any talk of Palestinian statehood after the Gaza war ends. That laid bare a deep division with U.S. policy, but the Prime Minister said he's made his stance clear to Washington.
In any future arrangement, Israel needs security control over all territory west of the Jordan. I tell this truth to our American friends. The Prime Minister needs to be capable of saying no to our friends, saying no when necessary, and saying yes when possible.
In response, the State Department underscored the U.S. stance that post-war planning must include a state for Palestinians.
There is no way to solve their long-term challenges, to provide lasting security, and there is no way to solve the short-term challenges of rebuilding Gaza and establishing governance in Gaza and providing security for Gaza without the establishment of a Palestinian state.
Netanyahu also insisted again today that the fighting will continue until there is a decisive victory over Hamas. In Gaza, the Hamas-run health ministry reported the Palestinian death toll has passed 24,600. And Palestinian medics said an Israeli missile destroyed a home in Rafah today, killing 16 people. Half of them were said to be children. On the Israeli side, the family of Kfir Bibas, the youngest hostage still in Gaza, marked his first birthday. They've had no word of him since his abduction. The U.S. military has hit Houthi rebels in Yemen for the fifth time, knocking out two anti-ship missiles. That comes after the rebels, backed by Iran, staged another drone attack on a U.S. commercial vessel. President Biden acknowledged today the Houthis seem undeterred, but he said the retaliation will continue. Pakistan struck back at Iran today with airstrikes that killed at least 9 people. It came 2 days after Iranian strikes inside Pakistan. Cell phone video today showed a large crater after a Pakistani strike on an Iranian village. The Pakistanis said they targeted separatists hiding along the border.
This morning's action was taken in light of credible intelligence of impending large-scale terrorist activities against Pakistan by these terrorists. Acts like the one which took place a couple of nights ago create difficulties.
Iran says its airstrikes earlier this week also targeted separatists on the Pakistani side of the border. Back in this country, this week's winter storms are now blamed for at least 24 deaths. The latest victims were in Portland, Oregon. 3 people were apparently electrocuted Wednesday after a live power line fell on their SUV. A baby inside was rescued. Yet another round of freezing rain is expected in the Pacific Northwest tonight. In Georgia, a judge will hear allegations against the district attorney who accused former President Trump of trying to overturn the 2020 election results. A defense lawyer alleges that Fani Willis had an affair with her special prosecutor and profited financially from the case. The motion seeks to toss the indictment. Willis has not directly addressed the allegations, but has defended her staff and her decision-making. The hearing will be next month. Severe drought in Panama is forcing authorities there to cut shipping traffic through the Panama Canal by 36%. Low water levels going back to last fall have caused traffic jams for the 50-mile waterway. It's one of the world's most vital routes for international trade. Canal administrators say they hope conditions will improve when the rainy season starts in May. And on Wall Street, stocks recouped some losses with big tech leading the way. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 202 points to close at 37,468. The NASDAQ also added 200 points, more than 1%. The S&P 500 rose 41. And Spelman College in Atlanta has received the largest single gift ever made to a historically black college. A billionaire couple, Rhonda Stryker and William Johnston, announced today they're donating $100 million to the women's school. Most of the money will endow scholarships. And still to come on the NewsHour, a bipartisan deal would expand the child tax credit to provide relief to struggling families. The Biden administration considers whether to ban menthol cigarettes. The demand for women-focused tourism rises as more women take solo trips abroad. And author Michelle Norris discusses her new book on how Americans see their race and identity.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Justice Department released a withering report today on how law enforcement failed in its response to the 2022 shooting attack at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. It's the most comprehensive assessment of what happened during the shooting that killed 19 children and two teachers. The nearly 600-page report lays out a series of, quote, cascading failures of leadership, decision-making, tactics, policy, and training. Attorney General Merrick Garland said law enforcement officers demonstrated no urgency as they waited out the shooter.
Officials on scene transitioned from treating the scene as an active shooter situation to treating the shooter as a barricaded subject. This was the most significant failure. That failure meant that law enforcement officials prioritized the protracted evacuation of students and teachers in other classrooms instead of immediately rescuing the victims trapped with the active shooter. It meant that officials spent time trying to negotiate with the subject instead of entering the room and confronting him.
Tony Plahetsky is an investigative reporter for the Austin American-Statesman and a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his coverage of Uvalde. Tony, thank you for being with us. So the DOJ is saying it wasn't one failure, it was many, and it wasn't the absence of leadership, it was failed leadership. And this report finds real fault with Pete Arredondo, who was the former school district police chief. Tell us more about that, and then walk us through the top lines of this report.
Well, Jeff, it is the most comprehensive and broadest investigation that has been released into the shooting. And in many ways, it continues to substantiate and confirm much of what the public has known. But this report is also striking in terms of its breadth in discussing the consequences of that and the aftermath of the shooting. So, for example, it describes that because there was a failure of leadership and no real incident commander, the time that should have been spent putting together, for example, a way to triage the children and the patients who were coming out of Robb Elementary School, that was not done. And in a very jarring and difficult to hear example, we read about a teacher who was left on a sidewalk outside of the school, not getting proper care, and later died. So the report itself, again, really walks us through the failed response in those precious 77 minutes, but also the consequences thereafter.
Let's talk more about the failed emergency response, because the report, as you mentioned, finds that medical teams were hampered from doing their job. Law enforcement was moving injured kids in ways that were probably more helpful. That's a direct line from the report. Several students with bullet wounds, grazes, and other injuries were directed onto buses to a civic center without having been brought to the attention of medics. How did the EMS response add to what the DOJ calls this cascade of failures?
Well, one of the things, as you mentioned, there was blood supplies, for example, that were brought to the scene but were not used on the patients. And I think also as part of this conversation as well, it was also striking that there was no way for ambulances to, in an emergency fashion, enter the campus because law enforcement officers who descended blocked the entrances to the school. So a question was asked to the Attorney General point blank today, would more people could they have survived had they been able to receive very urgent medical care? And his answer was a resounding yes.
Tony, how are the families reacting to this?
Well, you know, Jeff, the families of the 19 children and two teachers really don't speak with a collective voice, as you can imagine. They're all processing this in very different ways. Mm-hmm. But to be clear, the information that they received today is very difficult to hear. I think in many ways it absolutely confirms their worst suspicion and their worst nightmare. But now the conversation also continues to focus, as it has since May of 2022, by the way, on accountability and whether or not those families will ever see any sort of satisfying accountability in the aftermath.
Well, what does accountability look like now, Tony? Does the release of this report change that in any significant way?
Federal officials took great pains today to say that the scope of this investigation was not about identifying potential criminal liability, that was outside the scope of what they were doing, and as a matter of fact, did not find any federal crimes that could potentially be federally prosecuted. That means that accountability has to be done with regard to criminal charges at the local level. And we know that for many months, since really the onset of these calls for accountability, that the district attorney has said she is actively investigating. But as you can imagine, on the ground among those families, there's a push for something more timely and a more timely result of her investigation. Jeff, also, I do want to point out, there continue to be administrative investigations inside some of the law enforcement agencies whose officers responded that day. But the report actually points out the fact that these types of administrative investigations regarding whether or not law enforcement officers violated their own department policies, those similarly, according to this report, must be done at a much faster pace in order to provide the public, and in particular, the families of those victims, much more timely information.
Tony Plahetsky with the Austin American-Statesman. Tony, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
The federal child tax credit may soon be expanded as part of an effort by some lawmakers to ensure that more American families can access the benefit. If the proposal becomes law, it would gradually increase the credit from $1,600 to $2,000 per child in 2025 and allow lower-income families to receive a refundable tax credit for each child. Right now, many only earn one tax credit for all of their children combined. It would also adjust the credits for inflation and increase what's available to those who pay little to no income tax. Sharon Parrott is the president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That's a progressive think tank that studied this deal. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So this new agreement would actually provide smaller benefits than the monthly payments that some Americans received under President Biden's COVID relief plan. But you still support this proposal. Why?
Yeah, that's right. So the Rescue Plan Act had a very large expansion in the child tax credit. It made the entire credit available to low-income families, regardless of their earnings. It increased the amount of the credit for all families, and it provided the credit on a monthly basis. And that is a very strong policy that lifted millions of people out of poverty. And this is smaller than that, there's no question. But it still is helping 16 million children who now don't get a full child tax credit because their families' incomes are too low. And it's going to lift about 500,000, half a million children out of poverty in 2025 when it's fully in effect. So it is an important, meaningful step forward that provides real help to families today. And yes, we should continue to work toward a more robust child tax credit that can do even more to lift kids out of poverty.
I want to ask you about some criticisms of this proposal. The Wall Street Journal op-ed board says the package would undermine parents' incentives to work to receive the credit since they wouldn't have to earn as much income to qualify. Do you see it that way?
So let's be clear about what this proposal does. It says to a mom with a couple of kids who's working as a home health aide or a food server that they are going to be able to get a little bit more in their child tax credit. They are going to be able to get maybe $1,000 more than they get under current law. That is money that she can use to pay a utility bill, to fix her car so she can keep going to work, to buy diapers, to buy food at the grocery store. This is providing real meaningful help to working families that right now are shut out of the full child tax credit because their earnings are too low. We have an upside down policy right now where we give the least help to the families who need it the most. Now, let's be clear, under this package, families still have to have earnings in order to qualify for the credit. And the credit, unfortunately, actually still phases in as earnings rise. So families with some of the lowest incomes will either not qualify for the credit at all or still qualify for a small credit. But it is providing meaningful help to 16 million children.
The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, in a written statement, praised this proposal for finding offsets to help pay for it, but it also said it could still set the stage for substantially more debt over time. That's a direct quote. And there's the thought that given the popularity of this proposal, that it could become permanent and cost billions of dollars and add billions of dollars to the federal deficit over time.
Yeah, so let's be clear about what this proposal does. There's a series of corporate tax breaks, and it's paired with this modest but important expansion of the child tax credit. These provisions in this package are temporary and, as you said, are fully paid for. If Congress comes back to make them permanent, of course they would cost more. And at that point, Congress should pay for them. They should find offsets. And that's absolutely possible. If we ask high-income people and profitable corporations to pay a fair amount of tax, we can invest in low-income kids in ways that pay off for them, their families, and the country as a whole.
Sharon Parrott, president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks so much for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Activists and health advocates are ramping up efforts to get the Biden administration to ban menthol cigarettes ahead of an FDA deadline this weekend. This afternoon, community leaders and public health advocates marched toward the White House and staged a homegoing mock funeral for the 45,000 black lives lost to tobacco-related illnesses every year. But there's been a battle over whether the administration should finally enact a ban. Stephanie Tsai has the latest.
The decision on the ban has already been delayed after it was expected to go through last summer. White House officials are reportedly at odds over the political implications. But public health officials and the FDA say a ban would save hundreds of thousands of lives. Menthol cigarettes are a leading cause of death among Black Americans. 81% of Black smokers use menthols compared to 34% of white smokers. And there's a reason for that, says Keith Whalew, author of the book Pushing Cool, Big Tobacco, Racial Marketing, and the Untold Story of the Menthol Cigarette. Professor Whalew, thank you for joining the NewsHour. Start by giving us a sense of how great a toll menthol cigarettes have had on Black communities.
Well, the toll is incalculable. That is to say, smoking itself has exacted an enormous toll in terms of lung cancer, cardiovascular disease, and a wide range of other ailments across America. The menthol cigarette and the way in which the industry has pitched the menthol cigarette over the course of decades to the Black community has also resulted in generations of smokers initiated into smoking who otherwise would not have been. So the menthol cigarette is a key tool in the recruitment of smokers over the course of generations. This is a moment that has been long in the making.
The idea of a ban, though, Professor, has come up for years. Why does it keep getting delayed?
Well, you know, this moment has been a long time in the making, and the story really starts in 2009 when the Food and Drug Administration was given authority for the first time in the nation's history for regulating tobacco products. Imagine that. Only 15 years ago, the FDA was granted jurisdiction over these kinds of products. In that legislation signed by President Obama, flavored cigarettes were banned as illegitimate enticements, particularly because they were seen as important to youth initiation. But menthols were exempted, and the question was kicked over to the Food and Drug Administration. And in some ways, what we're dealing with is the aftermath of that decision. The FDA has tried twice before to move. So in some ways, we're really at the cusp of a story that has been playing out very, very slowly.
And in the background, isn't there a lot of lobbying going on as well that may be cause for delay?
Well, that's true. I think, you know, part of the tobacco industry's playbook has always been to, in some ways, latch on to a contemporary hot button political issue in order to rally the public against what most public health advocates and most citizens, frankly, see as common sense tobacco regulation.
There is an argument on the other side of the ban, including from prominent Black leaders who say that a menthol cigarette ban could lead to more criminalization of Black people. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the argument finds a legitimate concern, right? Police targeting of Black people, and they try to wrap menthol cigarettes around it. I really regard this argument as insincere, right? And deceitful for a couple of reasons. One, we have examples of entire states like California and Massachusetts that have banned menthol cigarettes, have banned flavored cigarettes, and nothing like this has resulted. So this is part of the big tobacco playbook to take a legitimate issue around which there is fear, mistrust, and concern and try to connect it somehow to what the industry sees as a lucrative but deadly product.
There's also, though, a poll making the rounds that suggests that banning menthols could hurt President Biden's reelection campaign during a contentious election year. And ultimately, the decision will be up to Biden, the ban. Cornell Belcher is a Democratic pollster who worked for President Obama.
There is some issue where African-American voters, particularly African-American voters in that space, look at a ban, and not on the broader tobacco products, but particularly on menthols, which they use disproportionately, and go, why are we being singled out and targeted in this way? There's a segment of the African-American community who thinks this could cause more harm, you know, prohibition could cause more harm than benefit.
Professor, we should note that the poll was reportedly commissioned by Altria, which is a world tobacco giant, as you know. But can you see political considerations influencing President Biden's decision on this ban?
One would hope that ultimately science and public health considerations will play the majority of a role in the administration's decision. That said, I'm skeptical about whether the political considerations that come by way of a Altria-funded poll that suggests that there may be a split in the Black community and there may be political consequences. I'm skeptical of those findings, partly because this is how the industry has worked historically with regard specifically to social science experts, psychologists, pollsters, who helped the industry figure out the best way to pitch an issue, to politicize it in order to protect a threatened and lucrative market.
Do you have a prediction, Professor, for how you see things going from here? Do you think a ban will be enacted under the Biden administration?
Well, I think that all of the scientific and public health, and indeed the political argument, is in favor of the Biden administration following through. I think the focus on how smokers will respond is only one part of the story. It's really about moves that you make, like banning television ads or banning billboards or banning Joe Camel cartoon ads. This is another chapter in a longstanding story to try to safeguard the health and well-being of the American public.
Keith Wailu, author of Pushing Cool, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour with your insights, Professor.
Thank you.
More than 60,000 Palestinians have been wounded during the Israeli air and ground campaigns. In a moment, Nick Schifrin speaks with an American doctor who's just returned from Gaza. But first, he looks at the state of medical care there. And a warning, some of the following images and descriptions are disturbing.
In Gaza's hospitals today, suffering too terrible to name. A mother hoping to find her son has just found him in the white body bag. They pray for him at the European hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis, 3 days after he left their home looking for food, never to return. Ibtisa Mohammed Gabar Al-Kura was told her son Abdallah was killed in an Israeli airstrike. He was buried so quickly, his gravestone is a cinder block.
I'm hurting like a burning blaze. I told my husband, let's pray for Abdallah. He will come back. But it was my last goodbye for him. May his soul rest in peace.
At Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, the wounded are rushed in. And there are scenes of desperation. This man, wounded, was brought into a hospital where triage is on the floor and treatment is often without anesthetic. None of Gaza's 36 hospitals is fully functional, and fewer than half are even operating. Now it's the area outside Nasser Hospital back in the south where fighting today and over the last week forced the displaced who sheltered at the hospital grounds to flee. The UN says Nasser Hospital is operating at double capacity, but Israel says Hamas used the hospital grounds this week to fire mortars at Israeli soldiers.
They use the hospital as a human shield.
Israel accuses Hamas of systematically using hospitals to hide. Israeli commanders have shown journalists miles of tunnels underneath hospitals. Last week, an Israeli animation of Indonesian hospital showed what Israel called a network of Hamas tunnels underneath. And just next to Indonesian hospital, cars taken by Hamas militants from Israel on October the 7th.
We find another route that goes north from the hospital, so they can, after they attack or do something, they can go to the tunnel in the city.
No electricity, no network, nothing.
But Gazan patients inside the hospitals are often powerless. Last week, Al-Aqsa Hospital's generators ran out of fuel, and the incubators ran only on battery. There are only three doctors left after international organizations evacuated their staff because of nearby fighting. One of those evacuated was Dr. Seema Jalani of the International Rescue Committee.
That feels very close. There is no morphine left. I've always told myself there's not much we can do in medicine, but we can treat pain. And it's no longer true anymore. So we cannot even offer any comfort here. There is no death with dignity when you're lying on the ground of an emergency room in Gaza.
And Dr. Seema Jalani now joins me from New York. Dr. Jalani, thank you so much. We just heard you say no death with dignity. What had you seen that made you say that?
In my first 3 hours of working at Al-Aqsa Hospital, I treated a one-year-old boy with a bloody diaper, and his right arm and right leg had been blown off. There was no leg below the diaper. He was bleeding into his chest. I treated him on the ground because there were no stretchers and no beds available. And when the orthopedic surgeon came to wrap his stumps up to stop the bleeding, I would have imagined in the U.S. this would have been a straightforward case that went immediately to the operating room because of the severity as a stat case. And instead, the impossible choices inflicted on the doctors of Gaza have made it such that he wasn't the emergency of the day. There was a waiting list, and the operating room was already full with other more pressing cases. And so I ask myself, what's more pressing than a one-year-old without an arm, a leg, and who's bleeding into his chest and choking on his blood? And that will tell you a little bit about the scale of devastation that the people of Gaza are suffering.
You're a pediatrician. What does it say that your expertise is needed at this moment in Gaza?
I've worked in war zones for several years, if not decades, and I shouldn't be useful in a war zone because I would expect that the survivor, the injured and war wounded would be young men. Instead, I'm disturbed to tell you that I was extremely useful in Gaza. At one point, we were resuscitating 5 patients from the brink of death in the code room, and 4 of them were children under the age of 15. That shouldn't be the case in the war. I shouldn't be useful as a pediatrician.
What moment, which patient, will you most remember?
There was an 11-year-old child who was brought in, and she was burnt so much that her face was charred and black. Her arms were flexed and immobile, and we did not have any information or contact information for parents, whether they were alive or dead. The emergency room was permeated with the smell of burnt flesh. And I just kept thinking that this is one of so many of a generation of orphans that are going to be born into Gaza, burnt and amputated and with no life to speak of, no access to services, no family members, and it will stay with me for all my days.
While you were there, another of your audio recordings, you questioned whether you were making a difference. Looking back, do you think that your time in Gaza made a difference?
I do. I do think we were there to support the healthcare staff who's on the brink of collapse. The doctors were showing up, having been forcibly evacuated already, not once, not twice, but somewhere 4 to 5 times. So they're scavenging for food and water and shelter for their families and showing up the next day in scrubs and with a stethoscope in hand and valiantly, bravely seeing patients. And one day there was a gentleman quietly sobbing in the doctor's area, and we asked what had happened. He pronounced a colleague dead overnight. And I said, should we leave? And he said, no, please stay and just see the patients today. I can't face them. And so I do think that us being there shows a solidarity and a support of the Palestinian staff, and they need a break, which we need a sustained ceasefire for this to be able to occur, for services to be able to be provided to people. We also saw many, many patients to try and empty the emergency room. The emergency rooms and hospitals have become de facto shelters, so try to continue to increase patient flow. And at the end of the day, it's the intangible. It's holding hands with a dying patient. It's holding the mother whose legs give out when you tell her that she has to bury her child. That's what we're there for, to serve people that are suffering.
You're back in the U.S. You're in New York. What do you want world leaders to know, whether in New York or Washington, D.C.?
World leaders need to acknowledge the scale, magnitude, and severity of the human suffering that is happening on the ground. We cannot look away anymore, and there needs to be a sustained ceasefire in order for us to be able to provide basic human services and dignity to the people of Gaza. And they have a voice, and they have power to make that happen.
Israel says Hamas uses hospitals as cover for tunnels. Did you see any evidence of any kind of militant activity in or around the hospital?
I did not see any evidence to suggest that, and the IRC would never work in a hospital that would be used for those purposes and condones any violation of international humanitarian law.
What do you say to the Gazan doctors you worked with, who you mentioned before, who, of course, are not able to leave Gaza?
My heart and my spirit remain with you, and I am doing everything I can to support your dignity and humanity, which we sadly have seemed to lost somewhere along the way.
Dr. Seema Jalani of the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A majority of people traveling abroad alone these days are women, and demand for women-led tour groups is rising. Stephanie Tsai is back with a closer look at the reasons why women are drawn to solo travel and how the hospitality industry is taking notice.
I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something.
Middle-aged woman, liberated by divorce, jets out to explore the world and find herself through travel.
And I'm going to end the year in Bali.
Between 2010's Eat, Pray, Love and the 2014 film adaption of the memoir Wild,
what have I done?
The solo female traveler has become a Hollywood trope. But it's not just in books and films. More and more women prefer to explore the world solo. A few years ago, then 23-year-old Molly Fury explored New Zealand alone.
I got to go on an incredible boat ride through Milford Sound. I went whale watching in Kaikoura, once-in-a-lifetime kind of opportunity, went snowboarding in Queenstown. So there were a lot of things happening that, you know, I'm not doing in my day-to-day life here in Ireland.
Yes, she returned with great adventures under her belt, but...
I came back and I felt like people were expecting me to have something interesting to say about it. I was kind of struck by the fact I didn't have some big epiphany or big transformation or self-discovery to share. The things that actually mattered or that I actually learned from would never show up in a film.
She later wrote a piece for Vogue titled, I Failed at Solo Female Travel, noting that what she learned on the trip was more mundane, how to shop, get gas, and navigate a foreign country on her own.
I was always afraid and sometimes panic-stricken when I first started out.
Barbara Winard did what Molly did in her 20s too, but at a time before solo female travel was as commonplace. Her first solo trip was to Europe in 1970.
People would always ask me where my husband was. Wasn't I afraid of traveling alone? How did my husband allow me to travel? And I didn't have a husband at the time, so I would make something up.
Now 75 and married, she still takes solo trips. But with many female travelers doing the same, she's rarely alone.
I may go places by myself, but I kind of have made a lot of friends who love to travel. So I have alternatives now. When I first started traveling, no one wanted to go where I wanted to go or when I wanted to go. So I felt I had no choice.
One of the people Winard met in her travels was Patricia Patton. As a young Black Pan Am flight attendant in 1970, she was already a pioneer. World travel pushed the frontier even further.
Travel has been really helpful in supporting me and my desire to live into the fullness of who I am, to push into those margins and my boundaries.
She says it's become more and more socially acceptable for older women, married, divorced, or otherwise, to travel solo.
Because so many of our mates have made other choices besides accompanying us on something that maybe we want to do, I think that women feel that they can relax, they can create the kind of memories that they want, traveling solo, and that not disrupt the relationship. Because that's an antiquated idea anyway.
And technology has only made solo travel easier, says University of Florida tourism professor Heather Gibson, who began researching solo women travel in 1998.
When we first started our solo women research back in the late 90s, there wasn't a mobile phone. And so one of the things that many of the women spoke to us about was, you know, fleeting loneliness, for example, or, you know, needing to find a way to share their experiences back home.
Smart mobile phones mean not only communications, but maps, GPS, booking accommodations are all at one's fingertips. And social media, of course. The solo female travel influencer has also become travel agent and tour guide, as in the case of Nabila Ismail. She's been to 63 countries, many of them alone. In 2022, she set off with the Dose of Travel Club, planning group trips for mostly women of color travelers. Their last major trip was to Iraq.
My idea is to go explore places that we have either heard about in negative limelight in the media or while growing up, and just countries that people kind of don't even have on their radar.
The 29-year-old content creator also uses social media to exchange travel advice with her over 100,000 followers.
It's helped me make my friends while traveling, and it's made solo travel that much more enjoyable. It also kind of fuels my travel addiction. There's always something new being added to my bucket list based on what I'm seeing online.
There's a growing market catering to solo female travelers like Ismail and her followers. Companies like Air India introducing rows reserved for solo women travelers, Trafalgar introducing a women-only set of tours, or luxury hotel chains offering solo packages in addition to honeymoons, or rather, one-y-moons. And post-pandemic, some travel companies reported that 85% of their solo travelers are women.
I don't know if you've ever walked past a mirror and seen your reflection and not recognized yourself, but often travel will give you that experience as well.
For Patricia Patton, years of solo travel have helped form her identity.
When I initially started to travel, I realized that not everybody lived the same and that I personally could decide how I wanted to live.
But whether for adventure, well-being, or eat, pray, love style epiphanies, it's clear women are more empowered than ever to travel solo. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
In 2010, award-winning journalist Michelle Norris started the Race Card Project, where she asked people around the world to send her a postcard and in just 6 words share their thoughts, questions, experiences, and aspirations about identity and race. The result was astonishing. The responses were vulnerable, honest, and revealing. And she compiled many of the postcards into a new book called Our Hidden Conversations, What Americans Really Think About Race and Identity. And Michelle Norris joins us now. Welcome back to the NewsHour.
It is great to be here.
The Race Card Project for you has been a 14-year pursuit. How have the submissions tracked this country's racial journey over that same period of time?
Well, when we started this in 2010, we were 2 years into the administration of our nation's first black president. And we were having a discussion as a country at that time about America being post-racial. So there was sort of a whoosh of hope in the air. And a lot of the submissions at the beginning reflected that. Only one race, the human race. Can't we just all get along? But over time, the cards got deeper, and people started to share some of the things that the viewers saw in the introduction. Reason I ended a sweet relationship, I'm only Asian because it's convenient, or when it's convenient. White, not allowed to be proud. And what we realized pretty quickly a couple years into this is that it was a little bit of a divining rod. Like, you could track things that were happening in the news or in society. They would show up in the inbox. So Trayvon Martin, for instance, the killing of Trayvon Martin, that did not become national news for weeks after he was killed in Florida. We were starting to see stories about people talking about an America that no longer felt comfortable to them or familiar to them in ways that we hear now, for instance, at far-right political rallies. You know, that language that has been almost normalized, we were starting to see it early on in the inbox. So as a journalist, it was not only interesting, but it was a very useful tool for trying to understand what was going on in America, you know, outside of the headlines, what was going on in really personal spaces in people's lives.
Yeah. You know, conversations about race in this country are so often trapped in the black-white binary, but this book breaks free of that. It reflects a real panorama of race, class, age, background. What stories stand out to you, and did you pick up any through lines, any points of connection among people?
There were certain through lines. The patterns themselves tell a story. It's actually the name of a chapter in the book.
Right.
Because we see a lot of people sometimes asking the same thing, sometimes saying the same thing. We have hundreds of cards from women of color who say, you're pretty for a fill in the blank. You're pretty for a dark-skinned girl. You're pretty for an Indian girl, or something like that, written in 6 words. And so you see that sometimes people are all climbing the same hill, struggling with the same things. But the other thing that's interesting to me, Jeff, is that not only do the cards reveal patterns, they reveal the way America is sometimes in conversation with itself without even knowing it.
In what ways?
So some of the cards feel like they're in conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, someone writes in about mugged by black teens, trust destroyed. You know, you get cards that people are talking about their fear of people of color. Mm-hmm. And then you get cards on the other side that fall into some version of, lady, I don't want your purse. You know, and so a card that came in, I'm not intimidating, you are intimidated. And so it's almost like a conversation that people are having across difference, across some sort of chasm. And sometimes it happens in ways that did these two people just talk to each other? And then there are cases where people actually aren't talking to each other, but they're talking to me. In the book, there are examples. There's a really interesting story about a couple. She's white, he's Iranian. They send in cards to the Race Card Project after listening to a segment on National Public Radio. They don't know that they've each sent in the card, but I recognize she's talking about her husband. And years later, I interview the two of them, and they're like, you sent in a card too? Yeah.
You know, in the book, you explore whiteness, which is interesting because whiteness in this country is so often seen as the default, or as you say in the book, the normative identity. There are a number of submissions that fall along these lines. There's one card that says, being white is not a crime. It's okay to be white. There's another card that says, do hillbillies get white privilege too? Yeah. You know, what do those submissions reveal?
Or another card that says, hillbilly is the wrong kind of white. Mm. Those submissions were surprising to me. Not the individual submissions, the volume of them. When I put the card on the, when I put the basket on the table and ask people to share their stories about race, most of our conversations about race in America are by, for, or about people of color. And they fall along that black-white binary that you discussed. But even when that happens, white Americans often have a bit of a bystander status. The conversation is usually led by or targeted at people of color. When I put that basket on the table, I never expected to engage in a 14-year odyssey of listening to white Americans talk about race. That was completely surprising. And in most of the 14 years that we've been doing this work, the majority of the cards have come from white people.
Really?
In America, or we also have cards that come from more than 100 countries, the majority, though, from America. And that was surprising and revealing and rewarding as a journalist because it helped me understand America in a different way. These are conversations that I normally don't have access to. And as you noted in some of these cards, there's a certain defensiveness sometimes. There's a certain sense that this conversation doesn't include me, and when it does, I'm always made out to be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. May I ask what your race card says?
When I first started doing this, my six words were, fooled them all, not done yet.
Oh.
Because I'm a brown girl that grew up in a Midwestern state. I'm from Minnesota. I had a speech impediment as a kid. A life as a communicator was not imagined for me, in part because of who I was and where I came from and how I presented in the world. And I didn't see a track for that. Didn't see, you know, there were no Gwen Ifils on the air when I was growing up. Over time, my six words have changed. And it's in part as America has changed. We're in a hurry to get over this. We want to be post-racial. We want to see the finish line. And I think some form of debate will always be with us because we're just such a variegated country. And so my six words now are still more work to be done.
Wow. Michelle Norris, the book and the intention behind it are extraordinary. It's called Our Hidden Conversations, What Americans Really Think About Race and Identity. And we also have to credit Kadir Nelson for this extraordinary cover art.
It's really wonderful. And the you know, I wanted a book that jumped off the page, so there are lots of photos inside. It's a very vibrant book about a difficult subject.
A real privilege to speak with you. Thank you. And as always, there's more coverage online, including an in-depth look at how misinformation is still playing a major role in vaccine hesitancy. That's at pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us.